Welcome to Ride the Omnibus, the podcast where we know nothing happens in a vacuum, and we're all about exploring. We're here to take you to places and times you never knew were connected, all by way of pop culture, new and old. Today, I am joined by our science nerds, Ellen.
Hey, Ellen Babcock here.
And Maria Johnson.
Hello, guys. Maria here.
And we are here at Ellen's behest to talk about Tales from the Loop, a new Amazon series. So before we get started, a quick note to our listeners. While we will be talking about Tales from the Loop, it should be stated that it is a 10-episode series. Each episode is a character study of a different character from within the world. While we are going to be discussing episodes 2 and episodes 4 in depth, there will be spoilers for those two episodes, but there will not be spoilers necessarily for any of the other episodes. So please make sure that if you plan to watch the series as a whole ahead of time, at least get to episode 4 before you continue listening. So before we get underway with episode 2, I want to talk a little bit about the creatives behind this series. The entire series is actually based on a book by Simon Stålenhag. He is a Swedish artist and musician and designer who specializes in retro-futuristic digital imagery. And he created a book of his imagery where he added science fiction elements related to a shadowy government agency. The creator of this show, Nathaniel Halpern, took the concept of that book and really decided to run with it and create a backstory to a number of characters in this fictional town surrounding the loop. Nathaniel Halpern is known for previously writing arcs for different television series, particularly Legion on television. Various different directors were hired for each individual episode. So as we go through the individual episodes, I'll share the information about them. But he did write each episode himself. So going into episode 2, titled Transpose, it opens with two brothers, one tying the other's shoes. And we learn that one is Jacob, and the younger one is Cole. And we see Jacob at school helping a friend cheat. It should be noted that all three people on this podcast are trained teachers who, you know, probably all had their own little reactions to this moment.
Yes, again, they were not good at cheating. It was pretty blatant obvious.
Cheating. Right. But the teacher was very good at not noticing.
Yeah.
So funny. Like, let me stare at my teacup really deeply and not care.
So kids at home,
don't try this.
No. Don't try this at home.
There is what there is there's a size disparity between the two friends, and as they sit there, the bigger one can easily look at his paper.
Yeah,
and the smaller look
at the smaller one's paper.
He does when he just kind of kindly sends that over. First, you weren't sure what's he going to do. Is he going to cover his paper? Is he going to guard it? But then he just kindly slid it over, so it really showed you how tight of friends those two guys are.
Yeah. And you see them together in the very next scene where Jacob is at his friend Danny, the tall friend's house, and Danny is lifting. And in the next scene, you see Jacob gazing longingly at this girl who ignores him. We learn later that her name is May. Then we see a punk band and Danny talking to girls. And we hear about the fact that he thinks he's getting recruitment calls about the loop. So this setup in terms of their relationship and their friendship, how did you guys feel this played overall?
It's critical to the episode.
Mm-hmm.
Critical in that you ultimately always kind of stereotypically think that the young, nerdy Jacob envies the taller, bigger, stronger, macho Danny. And it's set up that way. And Danny, the typical story, he's the one cheating off of Jacob. Jacob's going to share, so they're friends. But it's critical. And what's awesome about it is it actually switches that for us, that it's really Danny that is completely enthralled with Jacob's life, ultimately. But traditionally you think, oh, the nerd wants to be the big, strong guy that the girls talk to.
Mm-hmm.
It's their dichotomy is critical to the episode.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And they go to great lengths because they show Jacob helping his brother, but not just helping him tie his shoe. The brother's shoelace breaks, and Jacob removes his own shoelace and gives it to his brother.
Yes.
And then in the cheating incident, you know, he's helping him, and cheating never helps the person that lets you copy off their paper. So this kid, Jacob, is one who feels compelled to be kind, but almost always to his own detriment. And I really
had to spend the whole day with no shoelace on his shoe.
Yeah, the whole day without a shoelace. And whenever Danny and Jacob are together, they're friends. And they speak when they're alone together, they're friends. But when there's a group, Danny's off doing his I'm a popular kid thing, and Jacob is sitting all by himself. So it seems like a convenience friendship that, although Danny feels that he's really a friend, he's not really a friend. And it's very, I mean, I really identify that was like my entire school life was having friends that would put me down. Well, when I don't mean like put me down, but set me aside if their other friends that were more clicky got together, because I didn't do well in those situations. So I think maybe I didn't know it at the time, but maybe that was why I suggested this episode, is because there was a lot going on as far as seeing this very vulnerable. And also remember, he's the one being cheated off of. He's the smarter one. Mm-hmm. Let's just say it. We'll get it out there. The smart kid that's a little smaller than other people, not as grown up, doesn't even know how to squeeze a pimple properly. And he's sitting there with this hunky, gorgeous friend that takes him for granted pretty much.
Yeah.
As you say, it sets it up really well for the rest of the episode.
Yeah.
And that nerdy friend in the next sequence, we see him with his family. The younger brother is drawing a robot. And then we go to the dinner table where the mother is discussing what Jacob is going to be doing post-graduation. And of course, Jacob has it made. It's revealed that his grandfather is actually the head of the Loop, which is the government agency, as far as we know, that sort of runs this town at the beginning.
Can I ask a quick question? And I don't know. We're talking the Loop's a collider, right?
Right.
Right.
Because you can see it when they're walking around.
But at the beginning, like I didn't know at the beginning of this episode, you know, they keep talking about the Loop as if it's the name of, you know, where they're working. They're working at the Loop.
But I don't, and I'm not spoiling, I don't know if it ever is mentioned that it's a collider. Or are we just assuming it's a collider?
Well, my understanding of it is, since they show them walking around what is clearly a circular corridor with pipes that run through, it looks like an accelerator.
Right. Right.
And therefore that is my assumption. And whenever something is the Meyer Center for Research Physics, whenever it says research physics, you got to have a collider of something. You got to have something like that going on. Yeah. But they weren't clear. It was exactly when it was built and all that.
Right. And in episode 4, we definitely see something not collider-ish in the center. So that's where I started doubting Yes. Is this a collider or is this loop containing that?
Right. And that could be, well, because, well, a collider, I mean, you get a nice torus of high energy, whatever can contain a good magnetic field can contain whatever's going on with this other,
yes,
which I call the bit sphere.
The bits.
I called it good. The orb of bits.
Bit sphere. There you go. Well, but that episode is called, not really a spoiler, but it's called Ecosphere. So I went with Bit Sphere for parallel construction.
Oh, I thought it was Ecosphere.
Yeah, it is Ecosphere, but I kept thinking of it as Ecosphere. And I even wrote down like a capital H when I wrote it down, but still it's in my head as Ecosphere. I guess you can't take your really big passions out of the podcast.
I guess not. So. It's okay. It's quite okay.
All right. It's an Ecosphere.
Echo.
Echo. Okay. Sorry about that.
No.
Yeah. That dinner scene was great. Yeah. I loved it. So first of all, it also implies that they go straight from high school to working in the loop,
right,
as research.
Right.
No university.
In training. Like, so you go straight to an internship of some kind, which is very cool. But I also loved it because they were talking and they said, so what do you think you want to do? And Jacob actually says, I want to draw. Mm-hmm. And then his parents very politely have their jaws silently fall to the table. And then the father says, well, everyone needs a hobby. And then Cole, the younger brother, actually says, what's a hobby?
What's a hobby? And what's yours, Dad?
This family is all about work and career and serious stuff. And they just, and the idea of what a hobby is just didn't even come into it, which I thought was great. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then we see Danny, who is painting this crescent moon ramshackle barn red. And they're having the classic conversation about superhero powers. Would you rather be invisible or hear other people's thoughts? Which, you know, is a trope that you see in a lot of science fiction films. It didn't seem out of place here at all in terms of what we've seen so far in terms of their friendship. But
the only thing out of place was that Danny actually seemed to be operating at a slightly higher cognitive level with this one, right?
Yes.
So he asked him, what would you rather be? And Jacob says, well, I'd rather be invisible because then I don't have to know what people are actually thinking. And he said, well, you'd still hear what they had to say. So why even bother being invisible? Oh, well, then I guess I'll just stay away from people, says Jacob. So Danny gets the fact that making one choice has implications based upon the other choice, and Jacob wasn't quite there. So this could be the situation where, although Danny isn't book smart, he is a bit, I mean, his body has matured more quickly. Perhaps he's matured more quickly, but he doesn't have the intellectual capacity, the true one, but he's got some common sense in there and some ability to think. And Jacob is very in the moment, and he wasn't there. Mm-hmm. Which was interesting.
And it's foreshadowing. It makes you know that Jacob kind of is not really thrilled with this whole world, and he'd be happy alone drawing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He wanted to, that was what he really wanted.
Yep.
And Danny actually wants to not be invisible anymore. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Because in a way, because of his lesser academic promise, he is invisible because he wants to work in the loop. So Jacob's trying to be impressed into service in the loop, and Danny desperately wants to work at the loop. And then that sets us up beautifully, but he doesn't have the grades to make it. And so he's going to be working in the salvage yard or something like that, or
breaking rocks,
breaking rocks
in the
quarry, even better, even better.
And then that's a family business, right? You can work for your grandfather or something, breaking rocks or
there's something very feudal about this system. I mean, one wonders.
Yeah. But
teachers, it made me wonder.
Yeah.
Completely made me wonder.
People get seriously tracked very early on, although they were in the same class. Maybe that's because Jacob had been helping him cheat just enough to stay in the.
But I also got an impression it's a small town. So
they're very small.
Probably all in the same class because
there's
only one class.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And then, of course, this conversation that we were just talking about sets them up to go into the woods where they encounter the sort of mysterious robot.
Just lurking about.
Just lurking about. And, you know, then they discover this sea mine. And oddly, Danny is the one who sees it and is like, oh, yeah, go on, Jacob. And, you know, at no point is Danny willing to get in it first.
That's where I first started feeling that this was an awkward kind of scene.
Yeah.
Because Danny literally starts bossing Jacob.
Yeah.
Like multiple times through the scene. No, you get in it. You do it. And to the point, get in it again. No, you're going to get in it.
Are you afraid? Are you afraid?
Right. Yeah. And that's the, you know, it's one thing not being academic strong, but it's another being a bully.
Yeah.
So that's when I was like, Danny, no, I don't like Danny.
Yeah.
So when he was kind of bossing him around.
And fleetingly, you wonder, does he know something about, especially when you rewatch it? It's like, does he know?
Right.
Right.
And I couldn't figure that out on the rewatch this morning.
Yeah, not completely. I somewhat thought, because they made it look as if there was some degree of surprise there for both of them, but I don't know. It's still a lurking thought. Does Danny know what's going to happen?
And it was a lurking thought the first time I saw it, and it didn't go away the second time I saw it. But I didn't have any conclusive feeling. Hmm.
Didn't even cross my mind.
but what's interesting
is too nice. You're too nice.
But when Jacob gets in the sea mine and they switch bodies, basically, Danny is lying on the ground, and then the quote unquote Danny goes back in, because the real Danny, who is now in Jacob's body, is bossing the real Jacob around. It gets really confusing to try to describe this.
It does. Scene. It does. Once they're switched, I think it'll be easy to refer to them correctly. Yeah. But, you know, now that I'm thinking of it, it really does seem suspicious. So they come upon it looks like an underwater diving bell of some kind, slightly. And Jacob, still, the two are still themselves. Jacob is compelled to go in by Danny, goes in, everything just blacks out for a moment. And then you see Danny's body waking up on the ground. They figure out that they've switched. And then pretty quickly, one of them compels the other one to go back into the sphere. And that is where it gets a little confusing. It says, go back in.
Because Jacob's in Danny's large body. And he's like, I'm not going in there again.
Right. He doesn't want to go back in.
So then Danny in Jacob's little body, the same body goes in twice.
Same body goes in twice.
Two different personalities.
Yeah. Because then afterwards, and then they switch back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Danny, back in his own body, says, now that we know it's reversible, it's almost like he definitely orchestrated that whole thing in order to test it out and see if it was a reversible process.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
It's like a Machiavellian scientific process.
Yeah, a little bit. So they say, let's do it. And then Danny, in Jacob's body, says, let's do the switch and live as each other for a day and see how, and just experience that, be someone else for a day. And Jacob's essence never actually seems particularly excited about the idea, but they go ahead and do it to give it a shot. And then that's when everything starts getting very interesting. Yeah.
Wow. I think I just saw the birth of a conspiracy theory here. I think I just, because.
Well, but now that we've acknowledged it, we can set it aside, but yeah.
I was like, wow, it never even dawned on me. And then you're like, we know it's reversible.
Right? Oh. He says, So he was paying some attention in science class if he understands what a reversible process is, right?
Yeah.
So he got something from it. So I really wonder, I mean, was there some truth that got edited out accidentally, you know? But maybe they're just trying to keep
Which
it a little bit
makes Danny
fuzzy.
Even the horrible.
Well, and that and works. And that's
he went from being a bully to just being
just being kind of horrible. Because the show goes by, all the episodes have a much more paced out, one might call it slower, feel so that when you're used to watching the kind of sci-fi I normally watch, which is very action-packed, still thoughtful, but very action-packed, and there you, but with this one, there's so much time to think and to really absorb everything. Yeah. And that's when I go into my conspiracy theories, is in those quiet moments. I tend to go for conspiracy theories. But it gives you time to just spin out and say, what does all of this really mean?
Yeah.
Which is ultimately the essence, as you, the whole series is, because they never are particularly clear about what any of it means. And so you're, what does any of it mean? And so you're, kind of, it's an overarching theme.
And it's
slowly
so interesting,
not knowing what's
too,
going on.
Because right after they've decided they're switching bodies semi-permanently, the first person they meet is Jacob's grandfather, Jonathan Pryce, aka Russ, who is standing in front of a vacuum store, which I love. Like I said in the intro, nothing happens in a vacuum.
But so odd. I mean, I went and I looked that this is supposed to be dated in 2002. But the vacuums in the vacuum cleaner store were like from the 60s.
Did you see? I didn't see. I thought it was more supposed to be in the 80s. I didn't realize that it was supposed to be 2002 because I don't see that at all. It must have been.
I thought I read that somewhere,
also,
but it could have been completely wrong.
No, also on episode one, it's shown on the marquee of the cinema, Summer with Monica, the Ingmar Bergman film.
So I was going along with the, it's the 80s because the computers were also incredibly clunky, but it's clearly an overall alternate reality. It's not ours, right?
I mean, because the whole point of hiring, of developing this show from the retro-futuristic designer's work is, you know, taking rural landscapes with broken down tech,
high tech,
various different periods, and fusing it together with different time periods.
Right.
And I think the series overall lends itself really well to that aesthetic because it does a really interesting job of integrating so many aspects of the human experience, as well as taking its time to go through all of these aspects of alternative time building, as well as world building.
Yeah. That the whole image was so stark. When I looked back at the artwork of the guy whose last name I will not try to pronounce again, but Stephen
Simon
starts with an S. But the artist who first drew it, to me, all those, I know it was tech, but to me, it almost looked like abandoned military tech after a war or an occupation is what that appeared to me. But when I look at the what's present in the loop, and I had this image, and I have the sketch here, which, of course, I'm not showing. But I just when I was thinking, I'm like, where did these things come from? So you have the ground and then the loop is beneath it. And I almost saw like the bits of old tech kind of growing up and popping up to the circle, almost being deposited through vacuoles that just dump them into the woods surrounding, and they just go, so we're not using it anymore. It's kind of junk, and they put it somewhere, and it just ends up in the woods. And then people don't really know what they were even used for originally. Nobody had really turned them off. And all of a sudden, they start affecting people's lives very seriously. And so I wonder if the point of the show is what is the fallout of tech without heart and without purpose? And when you no longer know what it was for and it's sitting around just going. I see a lot of connections to Star Trek in this one, too. So if you look at like the Doomsday Machine, right, going around gobbling up planets with no purpose, you've got Nomad. And this one in particular, to me, feels like Turnabout Intruder. Right. And you've got the whole and them switching bodies. And
it's even more obvious than that. In episode four, the Echo Sphere, it's called what? N in the same font, N770. And I'm thinking, NC-. You know, I was like, what
is this? An oddly shaped nacelle? What's going on here?
I wonder why.
Right.
They would wonder why. Yeah. Very interesting stuff. So I got a lot of connections to all that stuff. So is it time to move into the conflict?
It's time to move into the conflict. So we have the explicit directions that they give each other regarding how they are to behave separately with each other's families. So
except I would say Jacob is explicit and Danny is not so explicit.
No, Danny tells Jacob nothing, but Jacob says, don't get me in trouble at home. Don't go through my stuff. And asks Danny for advice on like what to do about his sister. And we later find out that because his sister is deaf, he only communicates with her through American Sign Language. And Jacob obviously can't communicate with her at all, which is a dead giveaway that it's, you know,
a not problem. Him, right? Or it's a him. Problem. And so he says, just ignore her.
Yeah, he says, just ignore her. Just keep painting the barn.
And yeah, paint the barn. Yeah, yeah. Paint it's the like barn. He did all this to get out of his chore.
Right? It's really just a whole Tom Sawyer event is right. Really what this is.
He doesn't want to paint the barn.
When it could be that at first it was just I want to get out of my life.
If it was a conspiracy, it might have been just to get out of a chore.
It might have been. Because that's what becomes.
I'm pretty sure my teenage kids have done worse to get out of chores.
possibly. But that's also, I think it also underscores that they really weren't, I mean, or do any friends actually know each other's lives? So were they good friends or not? Because they don't know what's happening in each other's lives at all. Everybody tells people what they want them to hear. Danny had told Jacob that he already had offers from the Loop, as you mentioned before, Ariel. And then suddenly when they're in each other's lives, they see the truth and hear the truth from what's actually going on.
And the first part of the truth that Jacob gets to live out in Danny's life is he goes and he paints the barn and this, you know, cute girl comes up and he starts making out with her in the barn.
She starts making out with him and let's make sure that he's, okay. He does not leave character. But that makes him, it probably makes it all the more endearing because you've got this big, tall, hunky guy looking all flustered and not knowing what to do. And that's very attractive most of the time. So, And then they go there.
Yeah. And then he goes back and, you know, has his dinner table scene with Danny's family and hears, oh, well, you can't work at the Loop. You know, you're going to just go to the rock quarry and break rocks.
You have to make your decision and give up on your dream. When are you going to tell your uncle that you're giving up on your dream or something like that, right? Yeah. Something.
And then there's a tarantula in his bed who he coaxes back into his cage, apparently his pet. And
it was very, very calm reaction to a tarantula in the bed.
Yeah, very calm.
They're just little boys, you know? Yeah. They're just little boys.
Yeah. And we have weird dreams, apparently, in the night for both of the boys. And the next day at school, the first thing that Jacob's essence asks is, can we switch back now? To which Danny replies, please, one more day.
Yeah.
And, of course, we have one cheating off the other again.
Yeah,
only a little harder to do now that their different sizes don't really match up for it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now Danny, as Jacob, is kissing May, the girl Jacob loved, by the monument. And we have this indication of an identity crisis here.
One thing about the kissing, though, I was it went to show, I mean, okay, so Danny's essence in Jacob's body, he says that he was doing it for him. He was doing something good for
him. Right, because he said, what do I get out of it? And Danny had seen the sketch of May in the sketchbook.
Right.
Right. So he knew that he had a crush. He assumed that, of course, Jacob isn't going to make a move. So I guess if Jacob believes that he's going to go back to his body, Danny was like setting him up for a future with May. Yeah, I did this favor for you.
But if we believe our own conspiracy theory.
Yeah, but that shows that Danny really didn't understand how deeply Jacob felt for May.
Oh, he doesn't have deep feelings. They even say that when they're in the garage band scene. He says, all these people like you and you don't care about any of them. He
said,
Yeah. So, well, you know, not that we're stereotyping, but, you know.
Excellent commentary about not judging people, you know.
Yeah.
You shouldn't judge because you don't know what they're going through. And we don't all walk into Seabells in the middle of the woods and be able to switch places for a day.
Yeah.
Or two.
Or two. Or.
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 Yeah.
Yeah. So those dreams, though, they were very compelling. They were not good. So there's a lot of conflict in those kids.
Mm-hmm. There is.
And then when they show them after school, they're just walking and they're not talking anymore. Mm-hmm. They're just a long scene of them walking and not talking. And they actually don't even get anywhere because then Jacob in Danny's body is back painting the barn again. But that's when, as you said, that Danny in Jacob's body is off and walks by kissing May. So they were together. That was a definite existential scene. Just walking and not talking. It had tiny tones of Discreet Charms of the Bourgeoisie. Just walking and not talking to each other, completely in their own heads.
Right.
So that was.
And it's interesting because in the next part, you have the next confrontation, which is Danny and Jacob arguing, where Jacob is saying, I want to switch back. And Danny finally saying, well, I don't. And it's like, you know, here he is. He's officially stealing his identity and his opportunities for good.
For good. And Jacob, for the first time, is able to try to fight back for himself, but now he's the bigger kid. And so he gets aggressively ejected from Jacob's household, meaning Dan. And it would, because it's all switched. I mean, because everyone looks at it and thinks this is the big kid. Yeah. His own father kicks him out because he's the big kid beating up the little kid.
Yeah. Right.
And that's not what was happening. But, you know, he couldn't have asked it. Yeah. So I don't know. I will never know if it was intentional. But
what gets me is smart Jacob in Big Danny's body leaves and he goes back into so he's the smart guy who's going to work at the loop.
Right.
And he goes back into the sea mine on his own.
Yeah.
I mean, what was he doing?
Yeah, he didn't have a really good grasp of experimental design is what it sounds like to me, right? They had performed the initial experiments in close proximity to each other, and he feels so frustrated. And I think, remember, we'd already said that he was perhaps less emotionally mature. So right. he was going on pure emotion and anger and sadness and
maybe just being hopeful and just that being hopeful. If I get back in, the distance, it'll switch us back.
It'd switch us back. Mm-hmm. Because,
ultimately it doesn't.
You know. Yeah. Because if he'd really thought about it, if he had waited until Jacob was out of the house and out of his father's protective sphere, shall we say, then he could have just dragged him, you know,
right.
He could have, but his mindset isn't to forcibly drag someone somewhere. And so he did all he could think of. And it didn't work.
Sorry to jump the gun on that, but
I think that was the next chamber, I believe.
Yeah. That was the very next part. Right. And then you have, Danny trying to cope in Jacob's world, and Cole asks him how to draw a car, and
he can't draw.
He absolutely can't draw a thing, and so immediately Cole knows something's up.
Mm-hmm.
And
interestingly, also, so the younger brother Cole knows, and then very interesting, the younger sister knows.
Yeah.
So the siblings like know instantly.
They do.
Pretty close to instantly that this is not my older sibling.
Right.
So
that also, we say friends don't know each other. Parents don't know their kids, but But siblings, but siblings know they're siblings.
Absolutely do.
Because they see the truth, because they've known, they've watched them grow up, especially younger siblings, because they definitely are seeing the truth.
That's all they do.
Yeah. That's all they do is watch the older
watch
one.
Watch the older one. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And there's some pang of conscience that he feels when he gives May her portrait out of Jacob's notebook. You know, returns to the sea mine to look for Jacob, and I don't know what you guys felt about this scene.
Well, when he goes in and finds him in it.
Mm-hmm. Because you hear the scream, but you don't actually see what he's seeing.
Right. I didn't know what. I mean, it could have been anything. Because we don't know what it would do without the other person there.
We don't see until we see Danny's body in the hospital.
In the hospital. Yeah. So he could have been exploded. It could have been all over the inside of it. He could have been dead.
But what's worse is when everyone's like, hey, have you seen...
Yeah.
Danny, he's like, no, haven't seen Danny. Well, Danny's missing. No, he's around. He's around somewhere.
I haven't looked in a mirror recently.
Right. So, I mean, that just made Danny's consciousness now in Jacob's body more of a dick than ever.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it took, it seemed like, I don't know how long it took, but it seemed like a couple of days before he went to look and then get help. And so you have this comatose body.
Yeah.
Danny's body, which contained Jacob. Jacob's gone now. Obviously.
Jacob's gone ostensibly. Yep. And then they put him in. Then he has to do. And then that, I think, was just the, I mean, there are a lot of emotional moments, but when Danny in Jacob's body is standing in the hospital room looking at his own body, you know, on life support. And his parents
and
right
his
there.
Parents.
And he can't even tell them I'm here because that was just how thoroughly dissatisfied he was with his life. And he just, when he saw a way to get out, he went with it and he was going to play to that hand. That's where he was. And he couldn't even tell his parents. He didn't care enough about them to tell the truth and say what was going on at that moment. And that's it's very harsh to let them suffer. I mean, maybe in some part he thought that they didn't really care about him because they were fine with the idea of him breaking rocks for the rest of his life. Yeah.
And then you have the deconstruction of the sea mines and eventually...
now there's nothing to do. No way to get out of it. Yep.
No way to... get out of it. And so eventually you see Danny in Jacob's body speaking to his sister in ASL while he comes to pick up the tarantula. And the shot of the barn that was being painted with the musicians in it. And
the barn's done. Chore's done.
Yep. And post-graduation work at the Loop. And
so he gets to work.
Readily accept this, and they're so happy he's dropping drawing.
Yeah.
And then the robot outside the door.
Yeah. Which echoed the dream, right? Mm-hmm. So Jacob had dreamt, or Danny in Jacob's body had dreamt that Jacob was standing in his driveway in the middle of the night, rocking back and forth. And then he sees the robot in the same spot, rocking back and forth.
And he says,
and the very last word,
Jacob. He's asking if that's Jacob.
Yeah.
Which comes full circle because Jacob was drawing the robot at the beginning.
Yes.
So kind of blew your mind.
And that makes sense because the robot had been lurking in that area,
close enough.
Yeah, Danny wasn't actually in a coma. His body wasn't in a coma. He was just lacking the programming. He was the robot and he no longer had any programming. Mm-hmm. So it really makes you wonder at that, you know, what is the essence and spark of life? I'm setting us up for the next episode. Where does it come from? Can tech really steal it away from you? I mean, what's going on? Or, you know, do you have a do you just need the right vessel? And then it can transfer. And they didn't think to expand the search and think about what was going on. It's just because he didn't tell them, they didn't know. And it's just too much.
Yeah, you leave it with your mouth hanging open going, yeah. Oh my gosh, because yeah. There's just so many, yeah. Ooh, yeah, yeah, so many feelings, so many frustrations. And then if you think too hard on it, you'll see conspiracies everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, I do want to add a quick note before we move on to episode 4 about the director of this particular episode. She is a female director from South Korea, who is a very highly awarded for her independent films. She's been nominated for a number of Cassavetes Awards in particular for independent filmmaking the last decade or so. And I would highly recommend checking out her film Loveless if you ever get a chance to find it from 2016. We will get another higher profile director for episode 4, who I will tell you about after we discuss that episode in case it colors what you think of it.
Okie dokie.
So, talking about the spark of life in episode 4.
Hmm.
This one revolves around, instead of Jacob and his experiences, it revolves around his little brother Cole and his relationship with his grandfather, Russ. The opening shows Cole catching lightning bugs, or what look like lightning bugs.
Mm-hmm.
They're a little
not quite the same
looking. Yep. I don't know if this is part of the tech integration in this series.
Or... I have an idea for that, but I'll bring that up later.
Okay. And so, you know, you get these loving shots in his grandfather's backyard as he's catching these lightning bugs.
Cole was being protected from the concept of death at the beginning by his grandfather.
Oh, I totally missed
because
that.
His grandfather said he forgot to put holes in it.
Forgot to
tell the grandma.
I noticed that later, but I was like, why?
Yeah. So I was thinking about that. Yeah. That he was just protecting him from the guilt of having left them to die and suffocate. Yeah.
That makes sense.
Now we don't go into a magical transposition again into of lightning bugs turning into dimes. They don't discuss that. It just happens. And then he's got the jar full of dimes. Yeah.
No. And
at least we don't think they turned into dimes.
We hope not.
No, because we saw them. Remember later on, he actually.
That's true. The grandfather does toss them into the
toss them into
later.
The bin, and you see them there. Yeah.
Yeah. And then he's out gardening with grandpa, reviewing math just by rote. And he summarizes, the grandfather summarizes to Cole what he does at the loop. And he says, I prove the impossible to be possible. They apparently have a pretend gunshot ritual that they always do to say goodbye, where they each pretend to shoot each other and die in catastrophically comical ways.
Yeah,
So
it's cute.
It's very cute. And at this point I had written down that the grandmother really seems like a very incidental character at this point. Clara is the grandmother who's sort of in the background in all of these scenes. And then you get to Russ going to work at the loop in this brutalist gray dystopian architecture.
Uh-huh.
And we see him having a flashback to an image of a girl on a fence while he's sitting at his desk looking at his daughter Loretta through his office window.
Daughter-in-law.
Yeah, daughter-in-law.
Sorry, daughter-in-law. Mm-hmm. And then the call comes in from his doctor, and we think we know what that means, as it always seems to mean the same thing in TV and film, especially since we then get a cut to Cole standing over a dead deer.
Right.
And we'll talk more about this scene in a moment. But what did you guys think? We talked a little bit about the aesthetic of the loop before, but how did you guys feel about the way that he summarized his work at the loop and the imagery at the loop?
Well, his summarization was very Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, like, which was, you know, endearing. I like it because we only saw him briefly in episode two. And yeah, he just seems like a loving, decent guy who just wants to encourage his grandson. So I thought that was awesome. But when he's in the loop in his office, I'm like, oh my God, this looks so old. It looks so dated. They're drawing on these chalkboards. There's, you know, it's just these aluminum panel windows that are dirty between the two of them and stuff. Yep. It just seemed really, I mean, it seemed like really old.
Well, that's when you, if you go walking around in buildings in NASA Science Directorate, I don't know, Space Directorate is probably much more glitzy, but the Science Directorate, it looks exactly like it did when it was built usually. So in the 60s, and this place was, sounds like it was maybe built in the classic 50s, 60s or something like that maybe. And never, who cared about updates? All they care about is the physics and the math. Chalkboards work great. I actually have heard plenty of older scientists say they want chalk. They need to feel that. They need to feel the connection with the chalk and the board to know that they're thinking. You got to have to do this afterwards to know that something's good. So they're set in that dreary life making.
Dreary. Great word. That's an excellent. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dreary.
Yeah. So, but because they don't care about aesthetics. Right. They don't care about the comfort. And I mean, look, even in the houses, I mean, you know, we theorized that this was set in the 80s, but the houses still have the furnishings that were purchased in the late 60s or early 70s, big brown and green circles on the linen curtains or canvas curtains or whatever that was. I mean, it's all pretty dreary. And so they're, but at the same time, they're doing that, but thinking at very high level. So
thinking at Willy Wonka level
in a very dreary setting. So that's what I, and he's sitting there, and when Russ gets the call from the doctor, and then, as you said, we assume that it's the bad news that one gets from the doctor, and he's just, it's as if he finally notices the dreary existence around him. But just for a moment, but then he just thinks, okay, time to move on. Let's talk about who comes next.
But then we get into the next scene where he's going to be talking to Cole about his imminent death in a scene that clearly tells you where his priorities are, since Cole is the first person he tells in his family. You assume he probably told his wife, Clara, maybe before, but we don't know for sure.
Well, she asks if he got the call from the doctor. Did she call yet? And he said no, right after throwing away the lightning bug.
Oh, that's that's right.
Yeah, so we know she knows something. She doesn't know the news, not the result, but she knows that the test
she
was
knows
done.
That the thing's
something's up. Yeah,
going on. So back to the dead deer, Cole and his grandfather are approaching what we're assuming is actually the ecosphere from the title. The question is immediately from Cole, what does this do? And the reply is, this place tells how long your life will be. All you have to do is count the echoes. And so Cole has 6 echoes, and he makes his grandfather do the same, and his grandfather has none. And it's clear that the grandfather is trying to use this as a symbol of mortality, thought this might be a better way to bring it up with his grandson, but he walks away.
Yeah,
it well, he walks go away, over. But no, and doesn't he, soon after, though, he says, I have something to tell you. Mm-hmm. Doesn't he say, but it's the icebreaker, so to speak.
Yeah.
It's like, is it broken? That's what Cole asks. Is it broken? No, I have to tell you something.
Yeah. And so that's when he tells him the news. And yeah. then we get the conversation with the whole family. And after he breaks the news, it's a somewhat cold reception in the room.
And yeah, that was such an odd scene.
They keep reiterating, just wanted you to know, like, you don't have to do anything.
Just- yeah. Well, that, I'm not going to do spoilers, but Russ and the son don't have the most amazing relationship.
No.
No. And
well, that's not really a spoiler because he asks Loretta, his wife, to run the loop when he's gone in this episode. So that
right.
implies, why didn't you ask your own son? You asked your daughter-in-law.
Yep. We did know there was an estrangement because the daughter, when he's offering her the job in charge of the loop, he says, well, you know, I didn't go to your wedding. And she said, well, you weren't very happy about our relationship. So we know that there's that. Mm-hmm. That part of the schism with the son is set up in this one, but then there's more. Mm-hmm. But that I'm not going to go.
No, absolutely true.
Yeah,
and of course, like after the grandfather sort of feels this coldness from the overall family, and Cole has retreated to his room, he immediately yeah. goes after Cole again, right. making it clear that Cole is really the person that he feels most emotionally close to.
But let's also remember, I mean, Jacob at this point is sitting there, except he's not Jacob because we right, still know yeah, that. And he's looking around. Danny. He doesn't have a connection to the grandfather right, anymore because yeah. it's not his grandfather.
Right.
Yeah. yeah. So
and you have to wonder, like, does Russ actually know that? Because he's not even attempting to talk to him at all.
I always thought back at the beginning of episode two.
When he saw him in the streets.
When he sees them in the
when
streets.
When he sees them in the streets.
Right. I felt like he knew.
At the vacuum cleaner store.
I felt like he knew something was up. Because if he created the loop, he must know about everything that's out there.
Yeah.
You know, but what's, but then again, if he draws attention to it, then he has to acknowledge it. And then agencies would have to be brought in. And then that would mess up his funding.
Yeah. You know? Even if he didn't know before that it was sitting out there, after they dismantled it and he got knew. It back to the loop, he could make the connection.
You would think he
going,
would make the connection.
Oh my God, this, yeah.
But again, that's left for us to think of, right? And, but I did, he had that look like he knew something, something was going on.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But, yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that was a tough scene sitting there in that room. And, in that living room. And then he goes for Cole.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the scene with Cole is very much what you would expect in terms of age appropriate questions about death and the afterlife mm-hmm. of his grandfather. And his grandfather is as straightforward as he can be with him, mm-hmm. Which I appreciated.
Yeah.
And then we have the scene with Loretta, his daughter-in-law. And this is the scene where he questions, is the loop what you always wanted? And she says, yes. And he says, good, it's yours. You know, in spite of all of the other schisms that are acknowledged in this scene that we already went over, I found this kind of interesting. And sort of wondered what the connection was in this universe to women in positions of power in science. You know, is this so alternative a universe that in the, you know, 60s/80s/2002 timeline, this is not exceptional? I don't know.
Right. Well, remember, there's other things that we know that we can't say.
Oh, that's right.
Right.
Right. Spoiler wise. So yeah. Yeah, but I would also have to go back to this episode, which I didn't scan the faces for anyone that seemed to be a woman, and it what the ratio of male to female was in there. But I would hope that in some instances, if you get a smaller community like that, that they do recognize ability and capability. Perhaps, yeah, because if it's isolated enough so that guys don't have to flex, then
and
then they can deal with it.
And I mean, yeah, her and her husband have both tremendous experience with the loop and all of its fractals mm-hmm. That come off of it. But the husband's experience is much more negative of an experience than I think the wife's is. So,
yeah,
as a teaser to watch future episodes.
Watch future episodes.
To motivate you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So then we get Russ going back to reconnect with his grandson again. And they're out in the dark, and he turns the lights on.
And this is stadium lighting, basically, is what it looks like.
Yeah.
Huge pole light. I mean, it's out in the dark, looking out upon a wooded area of some kind. Or.
But they were drones, like, weren't they? Weren't they, like, moving drones?
I couldn't quite. I really tried looking very hard when I was rewatching, and I couldn't tell if they were moving or if they were just way up high. I couldn't
I think
tell.
They're just the towers that appear in the cover art.
Okay. It's possible. You can't see that clear. Well, honestly, they turn the light on. You can't see that clearly, yeah. But yeah.
But and it was a weak message.
I agree with that.
Like, oh, there will always be light.
Yeah.
No, it's yeah. You can, what is it? You can always find, you can always find light in the dark.
Yeah.
And this is part of the mixed message he's been sending this kid all through the episode. He puts the dimes in when the lightning bugs die. He's got the game where they kill each other but are always coming back to life and saying that they're okay the whole time. Then he says, I make the impossible possible. And then the grandson says, make it possible. He says, when Russ says, no, I can't change my outcome, that's impossible. And then the grandson immediately turns it around. He learned the lesson that his grandfather was teaching him.
Make it possible.
Which was that everything can be made possible. I can put dimes in instead of that. And you don't know that the lightning bugs died. I'm protected you. And that's when you see protecting people from the truth just comes around and bites you on the tuchus, because then they don't know what to expect and they can't deal with the truth and they're going to freak out.
Yeah.
And then you're letting them down. Make this possible. I can't make this possible. So you can mess around with physics, you can mess around with all kinds of stuff and make things possible, but when it comes to life, there's life and then there's death.
But ultimately, he contradicts himself.
He does, which is, yeah.
That's a confusing lesson for the kid, too.
Yeah, I think the mother clarifies it a bit more, says we can change things, but not this thing. Mm-hmm. You know, this we don't mess with. This we don't mess with.
Yeah. Huh. So right after they go to look at the towers and they're looking at the light, they go through their gunshot ritual again. Mm. And the grandfather stays down a little longer than usual. Yep. And then he pops back up again. And the grandson says, see, I knew you wouldn't die. Which then causes Russ to start sobbing alone in the dark outside his house. While his wife is sitting inside watching TV.
Yeah.
And he goes inside the house. He has another flashback and keels over.
That was very well done.
Yeah. It was very well filmed.
Yeah. It was. But when he went in and his wife's watching television, when he was like, we need something here on the shelf.
Yeah.
We need something here on the shelf. And she was like, it seemed like she wasn't paying attention. What? Huh?
Yeah.
And then he kills over. And that's where she ultimately puts his urn.
Mm-hmm. He was telling her where to put it. We should put something here.
It was very clear telegraphing in the script. Like it was obvious.
I thought so.
Exactly what they meant in the script.
Yeah. But she wasn't, I mean, she was watching television. She wasn't even.
She figured it out later, I think.
So, yeah. And when I think, I can only hope when two people are together that long that they're kind of so connected at that point that she doesn't have to pretend that 100% of her attention is on him at all times. At least that's what I'm hoping is going to happen in the future.
That's what we all hope, right?
That's what we all hope. Yeah.
So let's see. Then
so now he's in a coma.
Him?
No, not really a coma.
Well, he's in the hospital in a bad
dissociative state.
Let's just say he's in a bad state in the hospital. Cole asks Jacob to come with him to the loop to save him, to save Russ. And Cole is forced to go alone and opens up this manhole cover and goes down, passes by all the futuristic offices, hears the thumping, and he goes in and sees the giant orb of bits, as I called it. Suddenly his mom appears in the background, and thank goodness she stops him from touching it.
Yeah.
But, okay. Yeah. And that's before Russ has the dream in the hospital?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. About actually, doesn't Russ dream that he puts his head and like into that sphere? Yeah.
For all we know, it happened at the same time. It's vaguely possible. I don't know if it's... No, because that was before he'd gone to see him. Yeah.
Right.
But Cole explains to his mother that he thought it would cure his grandfather, that, you know, it was the piece of this orb that that girl had. And he's referring to episode one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So ixnay on the.
Well, I think we can spoil things that happen 1 through 4.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
Because no one's going to watch just.
Right. So he does recognize the bit sphere as what someone had, what the girl had had. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this is where Loretta explains that dying is a part of life. Cole leaves the loop dejectedly. And we see him at home rolling a glass and poking. In montage, we see him rolling the glass at the top of the stairs,
back
poking the deer with the stick, looking out the classroom window, and gardening with Grandma.
Yep.
So we see him revisiting the echo sphere and also smashing the glass jar.
Well, he loses, I don't know if he'd intentionally set it flying down the steps, but he either lost control of it or let it go, and then it smashes.
Yeah.
And that's when, and then the dimes are out. Yeah, that to me almost, like you said, it was a good montage with time passing and him coming to terms with death, I feel. And it also had a slight feeling of Circle of Life going on with that.
Yeah.
He's growing up and coming into awareness after having been protected and then suddenly having all the truth of the pain of life thrust upon him very, very quickly.
And I took this shattering jar as the death of his grandfather.
That moment. Yeah.
I kind of took those as parallel. I mean, I know later it shows him, them getting a call about George getting the call informing him of his death.
Dad says, I wish he would just die already. And then Cole says, I want to see Grandpa.
Yeah.
And the father says, just promise me you'll remember him how he was, not as he is. And
He goes in and it's terrifying.
Yeah.
He doesn't deal with it well. He spent a lot of time wanting to see him and he really couldn't handle it because it was unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was dissociated. Yeah.
Yeah. And we have the dream where Russ walks into the orb room and
puts his head into it. So to me, I wondered, did that mean that he must have. He has spent his life researching this thing and the properties of it and what they can learn from it. And at that last moment, he gets absorbed into it. Again, we had a little bit of 2001 going on for me here.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, right. And he puts his head in and dives into it, just gives himself over to it, and then he dies. And then I think pretty much right after, I mean, were we going to talk the sphere before we go to the end?
We were.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, so that it just definitely seems as if he's finally perhaps consummating his relationship with the bit sphere.
Oh my God. that's an image I'm trying to get out now.
Well, you know, I mean.
Yeah, I get you.
You know, we were talking about headspace before, and he puts his head into it completely. It's like, Yeah. You know, yeah. Just shit, mind meld. We got to do the whole thing.
Yeah.
My thoughts to your thoughts, my life to your sphere. Let's do this. Yeah.
Well, right after that lovely imagery, we get the phone call.
It is lovely
your
imagery.
Grandmother was there. He wasn't alone.
He can't, the father can't say he died.
No, right. He can't.
He can't. He tries to for a while and he can't. And he says, your grandmother was there. He wasn't alone. Oh, gosh.
Well, does he know something?
What? He's not really dead? He's in the bit sphere?
Well, obviously.
Obviously. Oh. Well, except no, because the grandfather was pretty clear. He expected not to exist. But then again, he's smart enough and good enough scientist to know that he really doesn't know.
Well, but what do you mean? How else were there lightning bugs in the ecosphere?
I'll tell you how.
The lightning bugs were
She's
sent there.
Get back to it after we get there.
We're going
to.
Oh, yeah, sorry. I'm waiting. I'm waiting.
Oh, jeez. Oh, yeah.
If I can wait, you can.
I've been fired. Oh.
So then we have the wake and the camera follows Cole and he has this weird little conversation with the bartender. But then he's going in to feel the fingerprints of his grandfather on the oldish 80s era keyboard. I think that was a computer I actually owned.
Yes.
You know, the relationship between Russ and his wife is clear here because Cole says, what did you do in here? And Grandma says, he never told me.
He never told me.
That doesn't speak highly of their relationship.
No.
Cole having a flashback to the opening shot of the film and of his grandfather and the lightning bugs together. We have Clara whistling alone as it rains, which is a callback to her whistling and expecting a response to her call from the grandfather. Cole goes back to the ecosphere. And when he looks inside the ecosphere, we see the lightning bug things. And Ellen's going to explain this in a minute. And we see this montage of all of his major rites of passage as he grows up. So saying hello through all of these individual rites of passage. So we see him, you know, resting his head on a woman's shoulder on a park bench, getting married, having a child, having a home, etc. And so I want to know, what are the lightning bugs about, Ellen? Because I have no clue.
Okay, so when you call into the ecosphere, right, this is, again, pure theory. And then it was supported to me by those flash forwards, as you were. Each echo had with it an image, so that as you heard the voice changing, because when you hear the echo, the voice becomes different because it's actually as they're aging, meaning as they're gaining experience as they move through life. And the grandfather was pretty clear that he felt that you no longer existed. And to me, that evoked the image of when you die, what's left behind is what you created. You leave behind your life experiences. I think this is all a giant Minecraft connection. And I suspect because it looks like the XP that comes out when, you know, as you're going through, that's what XP that you earn as you're doing Minecraft. They are little glowing green bits. So he puts his head into the ecosphere, the bit sphere. The grandfather puts his head in. And then I superimposed the image of Cole looking into the ecosphere. Right. So the grandfather puts his head in the bit sphere, the thing. Now, Cole puts his head into the ecosphere. And again, I had the 2001 thing. And it's like, my God, it's full of XP. So I didn't see the lightning bugs themselves. All I saw was the glow. When I saw the picture of the grandfather, that was a living picture, as you said, that he flashes back to, and you see just the green glow and the father and all of his life experience. Maybe it wasn't, but that's what it evoked for me, because all that is left is what you leave behind. And literally, when you kill a monster or you know, chop up a block of coal or chop up some diamond or chop up some redstone in Minecraft, and ding, 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 the little green XP comes out. And that's what allows you to be more powerful and enchant things and do all that stuff that makes life more livable, so that you don't have to be afraid of dying. Because when you die, you would lose the experience you have. But if you take that experience and put it into the objects in your life and make them more useful, then you have better quality of life and you don't have to be afraid of dying in Minecraft. So I know that's a bit out there, but that is what they look like to me. And that's where I went with it.
See, now, I got that it was the grandfather's way of saying, yeah, I died in that dimension.
Well, very possibly that's here, what the actual show wanted.
I mean, but because I still, the lightning bugs were unique to him and his grandson. And to have that fill of the lightning bugs, I thought it was showing that the
maybe
somehow that
bit sphere
allowed him to still communicate through the echo sphere.
Maybe the grandson didn't need to actually touch the bit sphere. I mean, you know, it's a field. It doesn't have to be a contact force. He was standing within the field of it. And so he could have been connected. And then the grandfather put his head in it in a dream state. And so, but it's still, it is a connection, whether it's, I know it's silly. It doesn't need to be the Minecraft experience. What I'm saying is that it was a manifestation of the experiences of the grandfather being conveyed through the tech, putting the heart back in the tech. We said, what is the purpose of tech without heart? Well, we have heart. It's called our life experiences. If we use them well, if we go forth and we learn things and we don't, and wherever we manage to not do harm, and then we pass it on to other people.
Right.
So, I know it was, but it was a clicking switch
for Cole's,
me.
Yeah, his and
he
Cole's,
and Cole's
experiences
with each other that were loving.
And it shows them, it's back to Willy Wonka.
Yeah.
Look,
yeah.
You know, keep trying to do the impossible.
Right.
It might just surprise you.
Lightning bugs are golden tickets.
But it's also back to the line that you were having trouble with, Maria, which is there will always be light in the darkness. So maybe the whole point is that
it was just a weak scene, the light in the darkness.
The original scene is weak. But
totally knew why he said it when you watch it the second time.
There you go. Yeah. So he knew that if Cole went back and looked into the sphere, that maybe just that one time, I wonder if that only happens the first time you go back to the sphere. Maybe that was the thing, because we assumed that Russ knew more about all the tech that was lying around. Maybe he knows that if you go and look together and then someone's going to die, and then you go back and you see
and
all
that would,
light in the darkness.
That would go with the whole sea mine switching too, you know, if they're paired together because they're right there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Fascinating. So, and this was, I wonder, as going back to where we started the whole show today, and Ariel, you asked me why I chose this, and I actually kind of knew in a way, but if anybody has listened to our first podcast, then about Hypatia and her circles, and, you know, this spheres.
Circles.
Yeah, I mean,
spheres are everywhere.
Loop, and that was actually part of the thing is I had circle in the brain and it went to the loop. You made me loopy.
And I made you loopy?
Yeah.
You know it.
Woo-hoo. Yeah. So, but you know, it does. And then the whole circle of life, like we said, and everything. I mean, circles do show up almost everywhere anyway, but why not? I mean, what's wrong with it?
And it happens in other episodes too.
It does.
In the loop, it's the whole circle of life coming back around, running into yourself.
Yeah.
And so spheres are.
Speaking of other episodes, though, I need to get this in really quickly. The director of this episode, episode 4, The Echo Sphere, was Andrew Stanton, who is better known as the director of such important films as Finding Nemo and WALL-E.
So oh, WALL-E. Oh, yeah.
He's done some TV work as well, obviously, but he's primarily known for those two animated movies. But I thought you guys might find that interesting, given that WALL-E is my personal favorite of all time.
And actually hearing that makes me, because when you read edits of this series, they talk about how it sometimes can be perceived as moving slow. Mm-hmm. So to me, that makes it all the more intentional. Because mm-hmm. yeah. both those movies in no way were directed slowly. So it makes the what can be perceived as slow very intentional, which is what helps with the whole character study, and it helps with Ellen pondering conspiracy theories and
making Minecraft connections. I mean, it gives you time.
And it's like when we teach mentally what's going on. It helps you find the connections. If it moved too fast, it would be something that you'd have to watch like 4 and 5 times to really get the connections.
But yeah.
It kind of slows it down for us.
Yeah. I'm also going to say, though, that I having watched the other episodes, there are other episodes in this series that I did write down that it felt like they were marking time. That, you know, they were just extending the runtime to extend the runtime, that it wasn't adding much to it. There was a montage with strings attached for no good reason. But I really feel in these two episodes that you chose, Ellen, that they were very intentional about what they were doing. And yes. I think that's an important point that you made, Maria.
So. Yeah, very intentional. And I agree with you that I can think of probably two episodes where I didn't see the point for the lengthiness.
Yeah.
But once again, maybe I would if I watched them all multiple times. But I don't think so.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, I usually can get a lot first time through. But. Yeah.
Well, now we come to the part of the podcast where we share what's been making our wheels go round this week.
Ooh, this is new. This is exciting. What makes our wheels go round this week? Okay, so I'm still teaching. So what's making my wheels go around this week is preparing thermochemistry lectures without demonstrations.
Yeah.
And trying to make those exciting.
When I say making your wheels go around, I mean things that are making you happy.
Yeah, it makes me happy.
Oh.
Yeah, I love talking to my students and teaching them and trying to make jokes about opening jars and attaching it to Q equals MC delta T. So, yeah, that kind of stuff does make me happy. Okay, the dead silence there was wonderful.
Sorry.
Well, crickets. You know, well, it wasn't dead silence in my head. Let's just say that, because when you're talking about teaching in circles, I was remembering a demonstration I did for mine, because we just did, for my classes, we were talking electrostatics. And so I did what I always, one kid always says, witchcraft. But it's the charging up a rod and leading a meter stick. You balance a meter stick on an overturned crucible and then get it to go through polarization and follow it. So I was sitting there with that circle going around. All that's great. And teaching was fun. Absolutely. But the stuff that's been making me happy, I don't know if it's bad to do a plug for future podcasts within another one, but I have been rewatching The Expanse and I did it really fast. I have two more episodes to do as soon as we finish here. And and I've done all of that in pretty much the last week. So,
oh, that's nuts.
But I've been focusing on that. And but that's what's been so watching that show, that's what's been making me happy this week.
Yeah, I guess Space Force has made me quite happy the last few days. So, I'm enjoying that. But you really have to look for joy anywhere you can.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, you got to look hard. You got to dig for it, like looking for worms. You got to look under wet, sloppy leaves.
What's making me happy this week? I haven't had to dig under the sloppy worms, actually. Mm-hmm. But I've really been enjoying doing New York Times crossword puzzles insanely much.
Daily ones or the weekend ones?
Oh, only the weekend ones.
I can't get that far. I'm more of a daily one.
I only subscribe to the New York Times Sunday. Just because I can't consume that much paper throughout the week. Like, it takes me a full week to get substantially through everything that I get on a Sunday. But those crosswords and absorbing everything within the New York Times is really making me feel great every single week. The other great thing I'm enjoying is playing Hanabi, this magical solitaire that you play with another person where neither of you gets to see your own cards. And you're building fireworks for the glory of the Chinese emperor. And it's wonderful. Okay. I highly recommend that game to anyone who ever feels like trying something new.
I don't even know what that meant, but that sounds very interesting. No, I mean, you don't see your own hand, but you're building fire. That's cool. That's got to be interesting.
So you can only call out, you know, like one piece of information at a time. Like you have three blue fireworks. You know.
Oh, so you're not talking strontium burns red.
No.
Copper burns green. Okay. I'm not.
And you're not talking about, you know, explosions and trajectories or anything like that.
No. I'm sorry.
Gotcha. They're imaginary fireworks.
They're imaginary fireworks.
Okay.
Too bad. But they could be anything.
Legal fireworks.
The legal. Oh, it's true.
Legal fireworks that don't exist. There you go. No, that works. No, it sounds cool.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining me today, Ellen and Maria.
And well, thank you.
Pleasure, Ariel.
And I can't wait to have you back on the show again. So.
Yippee! I'm not fired.
No, you're not fired.
We will
fired.
See
you're fired
you
up.
Soon in our next podcast.
And then you did just mention Transcendence, which was one of my favorite films, but I don't know. It's old.
We definitely have space for things that are old on here. I mean, that's part of the point.
That's why I'm here.
That's why I'm here. I teach old stuff.
Because I'm old.
No, I'm older because I teach ancienter things.
Oh, but I have more gray hair than both of you.
That's not true.
Yes, it is. It just appears blue in the screen, but it's gray.
Mm-hmm.